Left off a Wednesday night here in Revelation chapter 15, and had pretty much covered this page, but I want to go back through it just to kind of remind us of what we were looking at. It says, "After these things I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened. And out of the temple came seven angels having the seven plagues, clothed in pure bright linen, and having their chest girded with golden bands. Then one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven bowls full of the wrath of God who lives forever and ever. The temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from His power. And no one was able to enter the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were completed." And we noted this Wednesday night that the temple, or the tent of the testimony erected by Moses, was so called in Numbers chapter 1, verse 50, chapter 9, verse 15, chapter 10, verse 11, chapter 17, verse 7, chapter 18, and verse 2. In other words, it wasn't just called the tabernacle, it was called the tabernacle of the testimony. Because within the Holy of Holies rested the Ark of the Covenant containing the tables of the law called the testimony which God gave to Israel. Exodus chapter 25 and verse 21. So both the temple and the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven are used symbolically to represent the dwelling place of God. Previously, John had seen the temple open to reveal the Ark of his testament, chapter 11 of Revelation and verse 19, the seat of God's righteous laws. Now the temple is opened to bring forth the messengers of God's judgment against those who rejected him and his testimony. We also noted here that these seven angels are arrayed alike, reflecting the one who sends them. Chapter 19, verses 8 and 14, and the other passages that we have there. These had around their chest a golden girdle, such as that worn by the glorified Christ, chapter 1 and verse 3, signifying that they carried his message. He's the one who sends them. They are sent with his message. It is a message of destruction. It is not a message of warning, but a message of destruction and wrath. That brings us then to verse 7. It says, "Then one of the four living creatures gave the seven angels the seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God who lives forever and ever." One of the four living creatures, which are seen at the throne in chapter 4. Seven golden bowls full of the wrath of God. The seven angels come forth from the divine presence with bowls of wrath and await instruction from God to empty them. Linsky has well observed that the seven seals of chapter 6, introduced to the seals in chapter 6, and then in chapter 8, the seals are opened. Well, throughout chapter 6 and then into chapter 8, the seals are opened. They reveal what's in the scroll as each seal is opened. So the seven seals reveal. The seven trumpets of chapters 8, 9, and 11 announce and warn. And the seven bowls execute. The seven trumpets warned of the wrath of God coming upon the people. Here the seven bowls are actually pouring out the wrath of God. And so the temple was filled with the smoke of the glory of God and from His power, and no one was able to enter the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were completed. The smoke of the glory of God from His power. God's glory in action. You can see those in Exodus chapter 19 and verse 18, Habakkuk chapter 3 and verse 3. All of these symbols, all of these figures are to remind us of things that we've seen before, that Scripture has revealed to us before. This may be indicative of His anger in judgment and calamity, Deuteronomy 29 and verse 20, Psalm 18 and verse 8, Psalm 74 and verse 1. When the temple was erected, the glory of Jehovah, or when the tabernacle was erected, the glory of Jehovah filled it, and Moses was not able to enter it. Exodus chapter 40 and verse 34. Likewise, when Solomon had completed the temple, the glory of Jehovah filled the house so that the priest could not stand to minister. 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 10 and following. Now, no one could enter the temple until the seven plagues were completed. So that's consistent with the tabernacle of the testimony, the temple, the glory of the Lord, of God filled it. No one was able to enter. We see the same thing happening here. There's to be a completion of the pouring out of the wrath of God. So that's chapter 15. Any questions? Observations? Yeah, this is the, the inner sanctum of heaven, the dwelling place of God in heaven, the temple, the tabernacle of the testimony. I think the point here is that no one is able to enter the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were completed. No one's able to come into the presence of God until this is completed. And when you keep this in mind of the bigger context here, we've been shown the 144,000. The emphasis has been this message is to the 144,000. Okay, who are the 144,000? They're on earth, okay? It's the redeemed on earth, okay? The saved on earth, God's people on earth, in any dispensation. But particularly in this dispensation, when John is writing this and the generations that are going to experience the terrors of the Roman Empire against the Lord's church. So this is not written to say, you can't enter the presence of God until God's wrath is poured out on Rome. It's written more from the point of when God's, don't worry about the wrath of God being poured out on Rome. You're going to enter into the temple. You're going to enter into the presence of God. That's really, the point that's being brought forth here.
Yeah.
You know, the point that's consistent here is that from the temple, from the tabernacle of the testimony, what we see coming out from there, it's always of God. We're going to see that when we get into chapter 16. You know, it's talking about, you know, those that are in the inner sanctum of God. John, you had something? They were led by a pillar of cloud
in the day
and a pillar of fire at night.
Yeah.
Yeah. All of that, you know, being consistent with what we see. You know, primarily, I think you need to just focus upon when the tabernacle was completed, when Solomon completed the temple, that the glory of the Lord filled each of them. And that's what we find here. You know, this is the glory of God, you know, and the main point is God's wrath is going to be poured out on Rome, and having done that, then those who belong to God on earth are going to be able to enter the presence of God in heaven. You see, that's the point. Yeah. Yes. Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Anything else? All right. Chapter 16. And really, chapter 15 and 16 are, I don't even know if there should be a chapter break here, but there is. So, says, then I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the seven angels, go and pour out the bowls of the wrath of God on the earth. And so one of the beasts gives the angels the seven bowls. They're standing there with them and they're waiting. Okay. Just because they have them doesn't mean they can execute. They wait for the order to execute. That order comes from within the temple. So a great loud voice has been heard many times before. However, this time the command comes from within the sanctuary, indicating a divine voice. None could enter the temple at this time, as we saw in chapter 15 and verse 8. So the voice is most probably the voice of God. Now, if you wanted me to get specific on that, I would say it was the voice of Christ. You know, he's the one who had the golden sash in chapter 1. These angels are wearing garments that resemble his garment. He's the one who executes judgment. You know, if you had to get specific as to which of the Godhead the voice represents, I would say it would be Christ. But the point is that Jesus doesn't even say anything unless the Father authorizes him to say it. So it's the voice of God. These are the words of God, if you want to put it that way. And they are spoken by deity. They're not spoken by an angel or a representative of deity. They are spoken by God. Yes. Well, we'll get into that in chapters 20 and 21, about the book of life. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah.
Well, I'm just saying that since verse 1, you think it's Christ, and I think it is, and that he's going to be the one that presents us before God, because he was our mediator.
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay, but that's not what this is talking about. Yeah, that'll happen. That's true. Yes. Okay. John?
Can you tell me again? I wasn't here a while ago. What is the mark of the beast that they're talking about in the beginning of chapter 16? Is it symbolic?
Is it symbolic?
Is it meant to be symbolic, or is it something that's actually, like, people are going to be marked?
It's symbolic. It's not actual. I mean, it's just like the 144,000 have the name of Christ written on their forehead. Right? That's not literal, is it? Yeah, you need to be here. You need to be here. And when you're here, you need to be here. you need to stay plugged in. If you miss something, you're going to be wondering, okay? But yeah, that's okay. That's okay. I just needed to make that point. People get hung up on the mark of the beast and the 666 and all of that, okay? And they say, oh, that's literal, you know? And you've got guys like Hal Lindsey and all these other guys saying, you know, well, it's going to be a computer chip in underneath your skin and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. You've even got those who speculate, well, maybe this was some kind of tattoo that people were given, during the days of the Roman Empire. Well, the problem with that is that in order to be identified with Rome, this was an annual thing. You did it once a year. You went to the temple of the emperor and offered a pinch of incense and declared that the emperor was God. Okay, so they didn't get a new tattoo. If you got a tattoo, why would you have to go back the next year? You know, you're already marked. These are all symbolic, okay? Who are you identified with? Are you identified with God? Do you wear the name of Christ? Okay, literally? No, not literally, but spiritually, I've dedicated myself to Him. And I'm identified with Him, and He's identified me, and my name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life, and all of those other things, okay? We saw that when we went through it. You know, we saw that the 144,000, they were the name of Christ, okay? Then those who are of the beast, they are identified with the beast, okay? And it's 666 because it's not 666, it's just 666. Okay, which is not seven. Seven is the complete. Seven is the perfect number. Okay, six means you didn't make it. You didn't make it. You see, you're identified with the earthly. You're not identified with the heavenly. You see, you don't enter into the rest. On the seventh day, God rested. Okay, if you're of the six, you're of the earth. And you don't enter into the rest. You don't enter into the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony to get us back where we are. Okay, you see how all this is fitting together? Yeah, that's good. I see what you're saying, and I know what they're saying. They're just wrong.
Well, what I'm saying is they're saying,
I know what they said. Yeah. But that, I'm not teaching Jehovah's Witness doctrine. I know it's wrong. Yeah, I know. The 144,000 are who? Who are the 144,000? Are the redeemed on earth at any time. At any time. Okay? They're the ones who are identified with God on earth at any time. Okay? And are they virgins? Are they virgins in the context of virgins in Revelation? Spiritually, yes. They come out from the world. They're not engaging in the spiritual adultery of being married to God and being married to the world at the same time. No, they've separated themselves from the world. They're virgins. You see? You gotta see that. Okay? Yep. Right.
And that's why we come here together and we study it, and that's what the world doesn't understand.
Yeah.
That there are pieces of this that are figurative language, and then there's literal language, and then there's spiritual language. And if more people understood that and would come and study the Bible, they could separate the three.
Yeah. What the problem with whether it be Hollywood or Jehovah's Witness or whoever, okay, who want to take the figurative and make it literal, and they not only do they make it literal, but then they sensationalize it, you see, and then they go, wow, you know. And so, you know, you've got all of these different things, and people are taught visually, we learn visually sometimes quicker than we do by reading and hearing and studying. And so that makes an impression on us. And so because we've seen that, let me ask you a question. When Saul, remember Saul was going to Damascus and he was struck down, did he fall off his horse? A lot of people think he did because there's artist renditions of that with, you know, his horse up there and Saul laying on the ground. You know, so, well, Saul fell off his horse. Where's that in the scripture? You know, well,
does the scripture do the same thing about him being on the horse?
There you go. You know, but because we saw that, we think he did. You see? So you need to be careful. You know, you need to be careful about artist renditions of things. Okay, that's why everybody thinks the ark is a boat. Because, you know, when an artist sets down to draw a picture of the box that Noah built, he says, well, it just looks like a box. You know, that's not very artistic, you know. And so he goes to the next point and says, well, I'll make it look like a boat, you know, use some, you know, artistic liberty here, you know. And you might grant them that artistic liberty. But the whole problem is that the word ark means box. Okay? And even this guy up here in northern Kentucky didn't get it right. Okay? I don't know if it's because he's looking at pictures or what, but I mean, I don't know what his excuse is for that. But I mean, if you want to build an actual replica of the ark, it needs to look like a box. Okay? Now, I'm sure a lot of the other information that you would get if you went up there would be good to have. I might even go someday, you know. But am I in a big hurry to go up there? No, I'm not. Yep.
When we were talking last Wednesday night and last Sunday about some of this part, I thought it would be good to reiterate that, you know, chapter 1, he says it's signified, you know, that it's written symbolically. And it was also because it would protect them. You know, when it talked about Babylon back in, what, 14?
Right.
He was protecting his people from the Romans.
Right.
And they came along, well, what's that in the reading?
Yeah.
And it says Babylon, well, you know, they didn't.
So Rome says that's not us.
Right.
You know, so,
right.
Yeah, it
so
is.
I think that's good to reiterate.
I'm
for a reason.
Oh, you're good. It's good, John. It's good. It's good. That's a good question. It needs to be asked, and it needs to be answered. Okay? And you just need to see that, you know, that it's not literal. Spirit, you know, just like we understand, well, I'm a Christian, I'm one of the 144,000, and I don't have a name written across my forehead. Well, yeah, you do. Spiritually, you do. You see? Why is it written across your forehead? That's what you do your thinking with. You see, that's what he's, you know, you believe. Okay, John, or, what's your name? Neil? Just testing you. Right.
Doug, you know, it's not just the revelation that it's like Jesus.
Oh, right.
It's not washing literally sins from our body. In particular, the Lord's Supper, we're not physically eating his body and drinking his blood. It's figurative.
Right.
We understand that because we've read the Old Testament, we see the patterns, we see what Jesus laid down, so that's why it makes sense to us. But if you just say that to somebody off the street before, they're going to think that we're cannibals and weirdos.
Yeah, right. They thought Jesus was. He said, eat my flesh and drink my blood. You know, I thought, what? That's crazy. That would be crazy. But they didn't understand, even when he explained it to them. So I don't feel so bad. Anything else? Yes. I would. I don't know what he was thinking. I don't know what he was thinking. What's the big thing on the front of it that sticks up like a sail? I mean, it's even got a rudder on it. He's got a rudder on it, and he's got a sail like a... I guess in case it flipped over, he'd have a rudder on the bottom, too. I don't know. I don't get it. But, I don't get it. Anyway. It's symmetrical anyway. All right. All right. So none could enter the temple at this time. So the voice most probably is the voice of God. Orders are given to the seven angels to pour out the bowls of the wrath of God on the earth. Now, it's really important here that you know, realize that we're talking symbolically here. You know, it's very easy to jump and say, okay, this is what's going to happen on the earth. Is this what's going to happen on all the earth? Is the wrath of God going to come on all the earth, everybody that dwells on the earth? That's what you need to kind of keep in mind here. The earth symbolizes the carnal-minded, unregenerate of those who dwell on the earth. It's not the 144,000 who are identified with God. It's those who are identified with the world. They're earthly-minded, not heavenly-minded, if you want to look at it that way. So the first went and poured out his bowl upon the earth. And a foul and loathsome sore came upon the men who had the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. Although the first five plagues upon Egypt and the third trumpet affected men directly, it was not until the sixth Egyptian plague, Exodus chapter 9 and verse 9, and the fifth trumpet, chapter 9 of Revelation in verse 4, that the men were affected directly. However, In the series of the bowl plagues, man is grievously smitten from the very first. Okay? So, that's what helps you to understand that earth is not everybody on earth, but it's men on earth. It's specific individuals, you see. They're smitten with loathsome sores. Foul is the most often translated, evil. Thayer defines it as troublesome, injurious, pernicious, destructive, baneful, therefore bad or distressing, whether to body or mind. Loathsome indicates that which is painful, virulent, easy for you to say, serious, okay? Sore has an abscess or ulcer, a foul and angry sore, Orton Gingrich says. The word occurs only in Luke chapter 12 and verse 1 here and in verse 11 below. As in the human body, where sores break out from an accumulation of impurities that permeate the whole body, in this case, it is the corruption of worldliness breaking out. Only those are affected who participated in the false worship of the beast and his image and became corrupted by the immorality of pagan standards. And so we go from earth to specific individuals, and then it identifies the specific individuals as those who have the mark of the beast. They're identified with Rome, okay? They declare that Caesar is God, okay? All of those things. Just keeps getting worse. And that's what happened with Rome. They just kept getting worse and worse and worse. Then the second angel poured out his bowl on the sea, and it became blood as of dead men, and every living creature in the sea died. As earth was symbolic, so sea here is symbolic too. As at the sounding of the second trumpet warning in chapter 8 and verse 8, the sea here symbolizes the whole society of the unregenerate carnal humanity. You know, sometimes we use the phrase, the sea of humanity, okay? Well, this is a very specific sea of humanity. This is the sinful sea of humanity. However, this is not a warning, as the trumpet was in chapter 8 and verse 8. This bowl of wrath is focused on utter putrefaction of a dead society. Society was dead in sins and trespasses, and now there occurs the blood as of dead men, putrid and rotting and revealing illustration to the true nature of the spiritually dead. The result is death to every living creature in the sea. Moses wrote of the life of the flesh is in the blood. Life is in the blood. Leviticus 17 and verse 11. Consequently, when life is gone, decay and rottenness set in until one returns to the dust from whence he came. This is the irrevocable judgment of God from the very beginning. You shall surely die. You return to the dust, okay, of the earth. Genesis chapter 3, verse 19. Likewise, when the spiritual quality of the society decays like a sea of coagulated blood from dead men, it putrefies and rots, issuing a foul and obnoxious odor. Eventually, it returns to the unseen, Sheol, OK? Okay, Psalm 9 and verse 17. This too is by the judgment of God. Consider Sodom, the Canaanites, Israel, Judah, and all the rest of the ancient nations. When, due to spiritual decay, they were no longer fit to continue, God removed them. Society abandoned to idol, to idolatry and its consequence, immorality, really, should have put there, as was the society of John's day, is spiritually dead. And that's all he's showing here, you know, is that the society of Rome is a dead society, putrid. You know, if you want to flip this a little bit, well, what would be the other side of that? The prayers of the saints ascend as what? A fragrant aroma to God. Okay. Well, what about the sins of humanity? It's putrid. You know, it's the smell of death. I mean, you smelled dead animals and dead bodies before, right? Man, it's bad. That's what sin is like to God. Is that what sin's like to you? I mean, if you were to smell your sin, it would smell like death. Do you ever think about that? When you come into the presence of a dead, putrefying body, you don't want to stay there. Is it any wonder that God hates sin? That God is pure and God is holy and God hates sin? Just like we hate the smell of death, we should hate sin. We should hate our sin. Okay? Do you have something? Yeah. Good point. Okay. Haley observes in regards to this, in such a society, morals decline to the lowest level. The family collapses, schools breed anarchy and rebellion, business ethics become corrupt, entertainment becomes base and sordid, and printing presses exude smut and filth, until the whole is strangled in its own death blood and suffocated by its own stench. Our society also must listen to the trumpet warnings before God pours out the bowls of wrath. And there you are. I mean, you know, this was specifically talking about Rome, but can it be generalized? Sure. Can it be, you know, can you telescopically say, you know, I realize that's talking about Rome, but it could also be talking about the end of time. Yeah, that's right. The principles are the same. Okay. All right, we'll have to stop there. And we'll pick up with the third angel, verse 4, Wednesday night. That's more for my sake of saying that than it is for yours. Okay?
everybody had been washed down there.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, they were down there almost on their anniversary type of thing.
Yeah.